Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
If you're old enough to remember the first computer your family ever owned, and I certainly am, you probably recall how laughable it was in the late 80s or early 90s to imagine any household having more than one computer. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Today, of course, it's not uncommon for every member of a family to have a smartphone, tablet, or laptop of their own, not to mention the computer brains available to make our cars, thermostats, entertainment systems, and even household appliances smart. Some of the offerings in this emerging Internet of Things might seem over the top, but plenty of them allow machines to do things better on their own than we can. That's fine if you're in the market for a robot to vacuum your floors. It's a different story when your boss starts looking for a machine to do your job. So what is it we want from our technology exactly? Do we want computers and robots that make us better at what we do, or do we want them to take over for us? And which would leave us better off? John Markoff is science and technology reporter for The New York Times. He writes about the creative tension between proponents of intelligence, automation, and artificial intelligence in his new book. It's called Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots. John, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
We're at a fascinating moment in time when we want machines to do more and more for us. We believe we can make them, but we also have this real fear that somehow they might leave us behind.
We are. And, you know, it's shaped a little bit by the science fiction that we watch. Our view of robots is shaped by the Terminators and Chappies and HERS, Ex Machina that we see.
Ex Machina, yeah. That's a scary vision of the future.
Yeah. You know, I have this personal theory. It's not supported, but we kind of poke fun at the Japanese for being obsessed with robots going all the way back into the 1950s. But I think American society is actually as obsessed with robotics as the Japanese. It's just that we have a love-hate relationship rather than strictly a love affair.
How do we tend to evaluate, make decisions about when machines are in fact better at getting things done than humans? And this is not even a 21st century problem. We've been doing this for over 100 years.
Yeah, I mean, in a capitalist society, oftentimes it's made on a cost-benefit basis. And when new technologies emerge that do things more efficiently and lower cost, at lower cost than humans, they can replace them. Although, you know, it's not just that narrow. This is a nuanced area, and sometimes technologies that, you know, could displace humans don't. And trying to pick that apart is what I've been trying to do for the past decade.
There are two terms here that we need to understand in order to go forward with this conversation. Can you talk about the difference between intelligence augmentation and artificial intelligence?
Yeah, the sort of the path that I went down came from noticing that at the dawn of interactive computing, right around Stanford University in the early 1960s, there were two laboratories. One was started by a man by the name of John McCarthy. And McCarthy is the person who coined the term artificial intelligence, and he moved here from MIT in 1962, and he set up the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. And at that time, he thought that it would take just a decade to build a thinking machine, a computer that could replace a computer and a robot that could replace a human. And then on the other side of campus, at exactly the same time, there was another man, Douglas Engelbart. You probably know him as the inventor of the computer mouse, and he also invented hypertext, which became the basis for the World Wide Web. And Engelbart was a bit of a dreamer, and he really thought that you could take these computer technologies and you could use them to augment humans, that you could give us more intellectual powers. And he set out to build collaborative systems that would make small groups of human workers more effective. He thought that would solve the world's problems. And I looked at those two laboratories, and I realized that they had created two independent communities that sort of defined modern computer science, and that the problem was that those two communities didn't speak to each other. And over the ensuing five decades, we've had the artificial intelligence community. And the other community is largely called human-computer interaction. Those are designers who basically design from the human out. And those are two very different ways of approaching problems of computers and their applications in robotics.
What are the pros and cons of designing machines we expect to surpass us or to take things over for us as compared with those that we think will help us do things better?
You can go down many, many paths. I mean, the pros are that, you know, these systems can make human life better in many, many ways. Look at the discussion going on now in society around self-driving cars. We have made great progress since 2004 when DARPA began holding a series of contests to spark research in this area. And now many people believe that we're on the cusp of actually having commercial self-driving cars. The notion is you'll, you know, push a button on your smartphone and a Google car or an Uber car will pull up without a driver and will take you someplace. And that's in the American view of the future. Private transportation that's effortless and inexpensive and efficient is sort of one of the great possibilities. At the same time, machines are beginning to converse with us. We all use Siri, or many of us use Siri or Microsoft's Cortana or Google Now to get things done. And that's a classic example of a human-machine partnership, which I think is actually a good model. Another model is Google Search. Larry Page developed this technology called PageRank more than a decade ago, which basically mined human interactions to organize information. And the impact of Google Search is just, it's astounding. I mean, we all have the equivalent of the Library of Alexandria at our fingertips, and it's really leveled the playing field about knowledge all over the world. So those are the, you know, the really positive examples. I got into this sort of field by noticing probably a half a decade ago that there were programs, software called eDiscovery software that was basically doing the work of $35 an hour paralegals or even $400 an hour attorneys reading documents and doing a demonstrably better job than humans could do, and really beginning to change the structure of the legal profession. And I saw similar things happening in the medical field, where pattern recognition algorithms would begin to do the work of radiologists and change the nature of that field. And so I realized that that technologies that had not had a big impact on the economy were starting to trickle into the actually upper reaches of the workforce for the first time, and it raised all kinds of new questions about the rate of automation.
It also raises questions about the things that we assumed that nobody could do better than we could, or no machine could do better than we could. The thought that, you know, in something like radiology, that a computer, a robot that is given sufficient data to make actions and take action can do a better job than a human is unsettling, and not only for the radiologists of the world.
Well, if you look at that profession, the impact of technology actually didn't begin with pattern recognition software. It began with telecommunications. And there have already been dramatic changes in the profession because you can actually move the images around the world. And so you can structure the workforce in different ways. It's possible now to move X-rays, digitized X-rays, to low-cost labor parts of the world, or even to do it on a time frame where they can be read at any time. And that's about telecommunications, actually, more than it's about computing. But now we're seeing algorithms that can begin to match human expertise, and it's going to have an even bigger impact. One of the interesting examples of this happening in radiology that I just saw after I'd written the book is, you know, getting FDA approval for this technology is a long process, but the technology is actually working now. And so in the example of the ER kind of situation where you use this technology in a time-critical way, they're already using they're using the pattern recognition software to read X-rays and then sorting them based on what the machine knows is critical for the doctors to look at first. So if the machine sees something that's really worrisome in an ER setting, it'll bubble that X-ray to the top so it's looked at by a human first. And that's going on right now.
What's fascinating about a lot of this technology is that, you know, sometimes when we talk about it, we think in the future we'll have all these things available to us. But it's a little bit like the frog in the pot of water on the stove, right? It's happening little by little, and it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to get burned at the end of it. But it's not like it'll suddenly feel like a conversion. We're having a little bit more every day.
Well, I agree. You know, I started, I guess it was about a half a decade ago, as someone with my hair on fire about the rapid acceleration of automation and the impact it might have on the workforce. And I've come in the succeeding half decade to feel that it's a much more nuanced situation than is popularly seen in Silicon Valley. I mean, there is a view in Silicon Valley that all human labor will become obsolete by 2045. I mean, that's sort of routinely sort of the perspective of technologists here. And, you know, I actually think that AI as a field, since its very inception in 1956, has overpromised and underdelivered. And we're beginning to make progress right now. I mean, there's really been dramatic stuff that's happened. But, I think that there are many factors in changing a workforce, and technology is just one of them. And so we are frogs in the pot, and there are changes. But I think that you have to look at the situation more broadly. And one of the most fascinating things to me that I think is having actually more impact than technology are demographic changes. You know, all over the advanced world, we're aging. And that means that the workforce in many parts of the world is actually shrinking. And, you know, I sort of came to this view when I spoke to Danny Kahneman, the economist, and I was sort of saying that China faced social disruption as robots entered the manufacturing sphere there. And he said, you don't get it. If they're lucky in China, robots will come just in time. Hmm. And that really, you know, that sort of set me back. And I began looking at the structure of the population and the structure of the workforce. And you can't take a snapshot. In Japan, for example, the population is absolutely collapsing. I mean, the population is going to decline by a third over the next couple of decades. And globally, you know, by 2020, there will, for the first time in human history, be more people over 65 than there are under 5 in the world at large. And so Kahneman's point is that, you know, we might not get elder care robots when we need them, because it's a really hard problem.
And in terms of elder care robots, I mean, right now we have machines that can measure, you know, pulse and blood oxygen and, you know, deliver drugs at certain times. That's different, though, than having someone come and hold your hand or make you feel better as a human. Will we be able to develop machines that have at least some capacity to do that, too?
So I've been really looking at that carefully, and I'm not confident that they'll come in time for my generation. So if you watched DARPA's DRC, the DARPA Robotics Challenge that was in Los Angeles just a couple of months ago, that was really ground truth for where we are with robots operating in unstructured environments, supposedly autonomously. And if you saw the outtakes, I mean, it's really quite humorous, because the robots had to do 8 simple tasks, things like driving and opening doors and closing valves and walking over uneven ground and climbing ladders. And most of them failed. And these were the 24 of the best teams of roboticists in the world, given several million dollars in a couple of years. That's where we are. And I wouldn't want, you know, those robots weigh up to 440 pounds. I wouldn't want them anywhere near grandma.
John Markoff is my guest. He's science and technology reporter for The New York Times and author of the new book, Machines of Loving Grace: The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New York Times science and technology reporter John Markoff, whose new book is called Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. John, why is a DARPA robot, a self-ambulating vehicle, moving in sort of uncharted territory, dealing with such a harder problem than something like a Google driverless car, which we know are being tested on streets in many parts of America?
Yeah, in many ways, it is the same problem. The car has a little bit of an advantage because roads tend to be open and you can map them, and it's a sort of a knowable environment. The DARPA robots are sort of challenged to do what humans do every day in our home and work life, wander around in environments that are unplanned and have unexpected obstacles around them all the time. And that's a really, really hard problem for robots right now. Actually, it's an unsolved problem. The machines have made some progress, but the dirty secret about the DARPA robotics challenge is that the robots were largely teleoperated. They were wirelessly connected to human controllers, and there was actually very little autonomy that the researchers were able to develop at all. Even something as simple as reaching down and grabbing a doorknob and opening a door, that was something that almost all of the teams could not do autonomously. And so one of the people who watched the event, this was the son of Gil Pratt, who was the roboticist at DARPA who organized this, said, you know, if you're worried about the Terminator, just keep your door closed.
Why does DARPA want these things? Why is it spending so much money to try to develop at least the capacity to have autonomous machines in the world?
So that's a really important question. Gil Pratt went to DARPA, and after Fukushima, he realized that if there had been sort of autonomous or even teleoperated robots that had been available to the operators of those nuclear power plants in the minutes and hours after the tsunami, they could have shut the plants down in an orderly fashion and saved the catastrophe that happened. And he set about to basically create a contest to sort of jumpstart research to get there. And they made some progress, but they probably are, if you compare it to where we thought we were with self-driving cars, we're not there yet with those kinds of robots that could operate in those hazardous situations, particularly autonomously. That's ground truth. That's where we are now. If you're worried about Terminator, at least operating on the ground, we haven't made a lot of progress.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Aravind in Dallas. Hi, Aravind.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am curious about a fact. So if the global population, with its projection being somewhere around 20 billion in the next 50, 60 years, and the automation trying to catch up on different levels of jobs, right? So some things like taking an order at a McDonald's, if it is automated, right? So and given the fact that there is always a certain percentage in any population, in any country, who wish to do such jobs, right? And if those jobs does not exist, how do you think the education system should be modified in order to catch up with the technology and still have jobs? And also another thing is, what happens to the concept of work? What is that they will be doing in order to fulfill make themselves valuable when there are no such jobs? And the jobs that are left are really too difficult to do.
Arvind, those are like 2 hours of awesome questions. So we'll get some answers for you now. Thanks for your call.
Those are the deepest philosophical questions you can possibly imagine. But let me take a little bit of a stab. Population and the workforce. it would be really interesting to go back before the turn of the last century and sort of ask the question, when more than half of us worked in agricultural applications, whether we would have foreseen the kind of industrial economy that would emerge. And, you know, I think that's cited a lot of times. Now, in our economy in America, less than 2% of us work in those kinds of agricultural jobs. And you know, automation is continuing to change agriculture really dramatically. So my point in response to that question is that in the 1930s, John Maynard Keynes wrote about the impact of technology. And what he said was that technology destroys jobs. It doesn't destroy work. And, you know, the reality is the pie has continued to get bigger. GDP has continued to grow historically, and the nature of work has continued to change. And people have an apocalyptic view now that this, you know, this time it's going to be different. But I think you could make the case that this time, the evidence suggests that this time it will be the same and there will be new kinds of jobs that will emerge. And also, I have to point out that just because a job can be done by a machine does not inevitably mean that it will be. There are many, many factors, and it's very nuanced. I mean, often the thought experiment I ask people to do about this is take a job that could be readily automated today, the Starbucks barista, and then try to imagine a Starbucks without baristas, where you just go in and push a button. And what would that do to Starbucks' business? And I think that if you start to think that through, you realize that it's not simply a question of replacing every barista with a coffee machine. To the question of retraining, I mean, we're at a really remarkable point now. In Silicon Valley, a lot of people are starting to talk about this thing they call the gig economy. I mean, I'm a person who's been basically in the same job for my entire career. The new model is that people will retrain themselves continuously as they go from job to job to job quickly. And you need a new kind of educational system for that. And I actually think, I mean, Sebastian Thrun and Andrew Ng are two AI researchers at Stanford University who went off to try to sort of take a different approach to this problem. Sebastian created a company called Udacity. And he seems to have found traction. You know, initially he was trying to do these things called MOOCs, massively online open classrooms. And he's shifted his focus a little bit. And now he's offering something called nano degrees. And the idea is that you can quickly learn a new skill to make yourself employable in a new kind of work in a technological society. And I think that, you know, that's not welfare. That's where do you get the resources for a very dynamic and competitive society? And we might, as a society, think about investing in that. And I don't think it's, I don't think that's a radical idea at all. We did this in the wake of World War II in the form of the GI Bill, and we might come up with a new version of that to make it possible for people to train themselves at will whenever they need to do something new in the economy. That seems like a good idea to me.
Another interesting question is the extent to which we humans ultimately will trust robots and computers to do things that only people have done before. And this brings us back, of course, to the driverless car issue. As it turns out, we have a lot more faith in our own driving than maybe we should.
So this is a super interesting debate right now. So we've gone down this path towards self-driving cars. And, you know, the evidence to me is that we're not going to have commercial self-driving cars anytime soon. That's a really, really hard problem. There are these edge cases. Like, for example, I mean, my favorite sort of bit of evidence that it's a hard problem to solve is in April of this year, Google sort of shifted the direction of their program. And the reason they shifted their program from driverless cars in a completely open environment to these small cars they're building now that don't go any more than 25 miles an hour is that when they began to give their employees, you know, they'd had professional drivers sitting at the wheel and watching over the cars, and they did a spectacular job, more than 1 million miles without a computer-caused accident. But when they began giving the cars to their employees to commute on the way to and from work, they found that they were doing things, they were becoming distracted in ways they couldn't deal with, up to and including falling asleep. So that's what's called the handoff problem. And right now, the sort of the design of these machines is the computer sort of runs the operation until it encounters a problem that it can't solve. And then it passes the control of the car back to the human driver. And if the human's asleep or they're engaged in playing World of Warcraft, they're not going to be able to sort of get what's called situational awareness in the quarter of a second they need to avoid an accident. And, you know, we just have to rethink the problem. And what's really interesting about where we are now is a couple of weeks ago, Toyota gave a very large grant to the Stanford Computer Science Department and MIT Computer Science Departments to work on what they call intelligent cars rather than self-driving cars. And that would be that. That's a different model. The idea there is to basically put a little sort of genie or helper over your shoulder, and you drive the car. But if you're going to make a mistake, the computer will step in and save you from doing something dumb. And that seems like it might be more the model of the future to me.
Like the computerized version of a backseat driving spouse.
or a driver education.
Right.
trainer in the car with you. But the difference here is classic one of IA, intelligence augmentation, versus AI, artificial intelligence. And that's it. You know, my point is, It's a design problem. We have to, as humans, we have to decide what kinds of systems we want and what our relationship will be to these machines.
Here's something, John, that I've thought a lot about. And this is something that we don't talk about all that often with the internet. But, you know, people talk about, you know, you can go on Google and find anything. You get, you know, 10 million results for this entry that you put in. The reality is most of us only scroll down to the bottom of one or two pages. Maybe if we're looking really deep, we go six or seven in. You know, even though we have lots of choice, the way that somebody else's algorithm makes decisions for us often gives us what we want, but also limits our ability to explore. I wonder about cars that drive for us. You know, are advertisers going to offer you to pay for your gas if they can take you to this restaurant instead of that one that you intended to go to? And will we ultimately really just find ourselves in a place where we exercise less autonomy, even if functionally we still have autonomy?
Yeah, that's something that I worry about. I mean, I guess there's the science fiction way of sort of describing this problem is the Borg, the alien civilization that said, you know, resistance is futile, you will be assimilated. Mm-hmm. And we're now at this place where, I mean, I don't know about your city, but in San Francisco, I walk around the streets of San Francisco and almost everybody on the street is looking down at their palm,
right,
and, you know, getting their life instructions from their smartphone. And all the way, you know, from which Korean barbecue to buy to you know, restaurant to go to, up to and including, you know, who your spouse will be because you've gone to Match.com to find your partner. That's potentially very disturbing to me, and it seems like it's a generational thing as well. You know, I come from a generation that didn't want to take instructions from anyone, and now we're very comfortable in letting these algorithms make very subtle and sometimes profound decisions for us. It's a human choice. It's not clear to me that the culture that comes out the other side will be one that we're comfortable with. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book, to point out that it is a human choice.
Can we program something like human empathy and ethics into our machines?
So right now we're at the point where we're beginning to build machines that are conversationalists, that can have meaningful conversations. After I finished the book, recently I wrote about a Microsoft experiment that's taking place right now in China. They have what's called a chatbot, which they named Zhao Ice, Little Bing, and it's being used by 20 million Chinese. And unlike Siri and Cortana and Google Now, which are productivity tools, which are intended to, you know, you ask it something or you tell it something and it, you know, you go on with your life. Zhao Ice is intended as a conversationalist. And right now it's not speaking to people and it's not listening. You're typing to it and it's typing back to you. But 10 million Chinese are using it intensely. They're having multiple conversations, which are made up of many back and forths per day. They call it toilet time. They'll go into the bathroom at 11 p.m. and they'll have long personal conversations with Zhao Eis. 25% of them have said, have typed, "I love you" to Zhao Eis.
Wow.
50% have said, "Thank you." And is this creepy? I mean, it actually kind of freaked out the Microsoft designers. I was kind of creeped out because you get this very sort of sterile, if you've seen the movie Her, it raises all of these questions. And then I talked to an IBM researcher who was Chinese, and she said, you know, when we come to your country, when we come to America, we feel that it's very quiet. And her point was that in China, the level of social interaction is incredibly dense. And her view was that people were using this program to find a private space, to be alone, and to be alone with their thoughts. And that sort of reframed the way I thought about it. Maybe it's not as sort of frightening a thought. But clearly, we're going to be talking to machines. They're going to be talking back to us. People like the MIT social scientist Sherry Turkell are very worried about this. They want to reclaim human conversation, face-to-face conversation being something that they value, and conversation with machines or imaginary sort of software programs in our video games is something that seems very sterile to them.
Another thing that I love about talking about this sort of thing is that it again, makes you ask questions about the nature of what it is to be human. Thinking about, you know, artificial intelligence and having a conversation with an artificial being makes me think of all the times that we have to fake it in conversation and interactions with other people, right? Maybe you're in a terrible mood when you go to the grocery store, but you probably won't bark at the clerk. You'll be polite to her.
Yeah, you know, for me, it's shaped by the power of video games. And, I began covering the personal computer world decades and decades ago. At the very beginning, there was a company called Infocom. And Infocom wrote these things that were called text adventure games. It was all typed. And their slogan was, the best graphics are in your mind. Hmm. And I thought that was really true for a long time. And then about, you know, PlayStation 3 and a certain version of the Xbox, I began to realize that I was seeing things on the screens that were much more vivid than anything I could possibly imagine. And these worlds were incredibly compelling. And, you know, we've had a generation of youngsters who've sort of disappeared into that world. And I think it's both very powerful and also frightening the way you frame it.
John Markoff is my guest. He's science and technology reporter for the New York Times and author of the new book, Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. Join it by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with science and technology writer John Markoff, author of the new book, Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots. Join us by emailing think@kera.org, which is where we hear from Leonard in Arlington, who writes, I just watched a clip from Charlie Chaplin's 1930 classic Modern Times, where he's working at a factory, and to save time, supervisors bring in a machine to feed him. As you can imagine, everything goes wrong. If we succumb to such automation, we as humans forget how to take care of our own needs. There's a limit to automation for our own evolution. Thoughts on that?
Wow. So my sense is that this is something we can control. It's a very human problem that we're facing. The machines are not evolving on their own, and they're not going to evolve by themselves anytime soon. This is something that, let's say, let's look at IBM, who has a set of technologies that they call Watson, and they're working very closely with hospitals and with doctors. And I'm going to be fascinated to see what IBM decides to do with the Watson technology with respect to doctors, because you could use it in several different ways. You can make a doctor smarter by basically giving him a tool, or he or she a tool that will allow them to be better at diagnosing illnesses. Or alternately, you could use that technology to sort of dumb the profession down. You could basically create a triage system where you had more physician's assistants, fewer doctors. You entered the hospital and you would be interrogated by a machine and perhaps wouldn't see a human at all. And I can see it going either way. But my point is that humans will design these systems, and it's our choice if we design ourselves into or out of this future.
It's interesting, too, and I think Leonard's point is a fascinating one, but it occurs to me that, you know, my grandmother's grandmother knew how to put up enough vegetables to get the family through a winter when they couldn't grow anything, and she knew how to kill a chicken, and she knew how to, you know, help a neighbor give birth, and she knew had lots of life skills, building a fire that I don't have, but I'm just fine today. It may be that we simply trade off things that we used to have to know how to do to live in the world as technology progresses.
Yeah, I am really interested in this question of whether elder robots will come in time and what our relationship should be to these machines that might take care of us. Any of us who are of the age where we're beginning to take care of our aging parents are confronted with sort of, you know, all of a sudden you become the adult and they become the child. And I wonder whether you could insert machines in into that sort of care model that wouldn't dehumanize either the people who are being cared for, the aging humans, or the caregivers. And right now, it's to your earlier question, it's kind of an academic point because for me, the metric is, when will we have a machine that could give an aging human a shower safely? And we're nowhere near that yet. But at some point, that might be possible. And then you have to ask the question, is it the right thing to do?
Let's go to the phones now at 800-933-5372. Rob is on the line in Allen. Hello, Rob.
Hi there. Mr. Markov, I feel that your focus has been on the present and the near future. And that's understandable, but I can even pick up on the point that you just mentioned about elder robots. I think maybe we're entering a golden age here where we're going to be in an age of robot symbiosis for the next 20 to 30 years. But when we get to that point of singularity where the machine learning has it's developed, intelligence to the point where it's human intelligence, what we're asking to do is build a super intelligence that we can use for our own purposes and that we want to keep controlling. And I just don't think that's going to be possible.
Let me first say that that's a widely held perspective in Silicon Valley. People like Ray Kurzweil or internationally people like Nick Bostrom believe that machines are evolving at that pace. And I'm a skeptic. I think that we still don't understand well enough how the human mind works to model it. It's too early, and I don't see the path there. Let me just a little bit on singularity. It's a term that was first proposed by John von Neumann, the mathematician, and then later sort of popularized by computer scientist and science fiction writer Werner Vinge. And it's at that point, it is that point in time when human intelligence is surpassed by machine intelligence. And there is a widespread belief in Silicon Valley that we are in this world of accelerating technologies and that this kind of transition point is inevitable. And I've come to be extremely skeptical about this, particularly because the AI field, since its inception in 1956, has overpromised and underdelivered, and it's that Rocky and Bullwinkle sort of back and forth, But Bullwinkle, that trick never works this time for sure. So prove it. Let's see. I mean, what we've seen, what's on the table is dramatic increases in machine perception. We have not seen significant advances in machine cognition. Those are still very, very hard problems. And I have a piece in last Sunday's New York Times about the slowing rate of Moore's Law. According to the Kurzweil model of the world, we're getting faster, and these machines are getting cheaper, cheaper more quickly as well. My point is that those aspects of Moore's law have stopped functioning. Clock speed stopped accelerating a decade ago. More significantly, the cost of individual transistors has stopped falling. We're running into the molecular limits. And now Kurzweil would respond to me, well, okay, all of these exponentials ultimately become S-curves, but they're linked S-curves. And there will be a new technology that will come along that will continue to accelerate our progress. And that may be true. I'm willing to accept that that's a possibility. I'm just looking at the ground truth right now and saying that I don't see the connection between those dots. You can wave your hands and say that machines will become super intelligent, but they can't open doors right now. So maybe you're right, but it's yet to be proven.
Why do we have so much anxiety about this?
The simple answer is too much science fiction. let's blame Hollywood. No, I think that, for example, to the last caller's point, there are a group of technologists and, Hawking and Musk and Gates have all said that we may be summoning the demon in this technology. And I think they're wrong that it's not advancing as fast as they assert. However, they're raising an extremely important question. And I do think that we have every right to be anxious about basically sort of placing decision-making in machines and separating it from human control. And you can particularly clearly see that in weapon systems. We're on the brink of developing machines that make killing decisions. And if we're going to cross that boundary, I think we need, as a world, not just a society, we need to think deeply about the consequences. You could imagine there's an Israeli weapon that's deployed right now called the Harpy, and it loiters in the air and waits for a particular radar to turn on, and then it kills it without it attacks it without any human intervention. Imagine adding facial recognition technology to American drones and letting them do the same thing. I don't know if we want to go down that path, but it's technically feasible without thinking at all about whether machines are self-aware.
I also think about, there's the old idea that, God made man in his own image. Man makes machine in his own image. And we know that we are very messed up in many ways.
Yeah, the building sort of the anthropomorphic machines. I mean, we tend to anthropomorphize everything. Our cars, our pets. Why not our robots? And this is something. There was a computer scientist who developed an early conversational system called ELIZA in the 1960s, and then let his students use it at MIT. And he was alarmed that ELIZA was. It was barely capable of carrying on a conversation, and yet his students became deeply absorbed in it, and they poured out their hearts to it and their most intimate thoughts. And I saw that when I covered the very first Turing contest. I mean, Alan Turing, the mathematician, proposed this test for human intelligence or machine intelligence, that if you could type for an extended period to a terminal, and if you could not tell that it was a human or a machine, you could say that it was artificially intelligent.
Right.
And in 1991, when they had the first contest, they had two sets of judges. One set of judges were computer scientists, and they could very easily see that these machines were not intelligent, but they picked another group of judges off the street. And for all practical purposes, for that group, for the non-technical humans, the Turing test was passed several decades ago.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Paul is on the line now in Mesquite. Hi, Paul.
Hi. We recently bought long-term care insurance, and the insurance company stipulated that we would not be able to spend the money on technology. We'd have to spend it on people. I wonder if they were anticipating a robotic care device.
Wow. I'm not familiar with those kinds of decisions, although just as a very general point, oftentimes those sort of legal structures or investment decisions have tremendous second order effects, often more impact than any particular technology advance. And so possibly this would discourage the development of elder care robots. On the other side of the coin, right now in Europe, the European Union is spending more than €1 billion to develop elder care robots that don't exist today to begin to do some of these things. You know, in the United States, the kinds of the robotic caregiving machine ideas right now are very elementary. I know people who are designing machines that can move around and scoop things up that have been dropped because, as you know, you become old, it becomes very difficult to pick things up. And they argue that a device like that would be useful in a home, or maybe a device that could give you the correct medicine at the correct time accurately would be useful in the home.
What do we need to think about with regard to privacy as we start to give automation and give, you know, sort of sensory perception to a lot more of our devices? You know, you think about we're talking a lot these days about police officers wearing cameras. What if every car on the road had cameras recording everything that was happening as they go by?
And they will. And I guess that's one of these decisions we have to make as a society. There is a lobbying group in Washington, D.C. called the Electronic Privacy Information Center. And they have a campaign now calling for, their term is algorithmic transparency. And given what just happened with Volkswagen, you could see why algorithmic transparency might be something that would be good for society, particularly with respect to the privacy issues you're talking about. When we're at the cusp of doing things, you talked about cameras, but there are also microphones surrounding us increasingly everywhere we are. Amazon has a product called Echo. Siri and other devices like it are tending to be on all the time. And so in theory, they could be listening to you anytime, and it would be really great to know what was going on inside the machine and whether you actually had privacy. But on a deeper level, it seems like as a society, we're becoming more comfortable with the panopticon. You know, it cuts both ways. And I have deep reservations about it. But as a society, we seem to be divided. And I can't quite understand which direction we're going. I mean, we want our police to be instrumented so that we know what they're doing. There are cameras increasingly on every corner for all kinds of reasons. It's just extraordinary to me now that whenever a crime happens, there's video footage of it somewhere. That's just a statement of where we are, and we haven't even begun to get to where the Internet of Things will take us, where everything will be a sensor. So how do we get back to the kind of privacy rules that we had in the last century? I'm not sure we can go back.
Very quickly, if you were writing a novel about the year 2115, would it be a dystopia or a utopia?
Oh, I grew up with cyberpunk. I'm sure it would be dystopia, sadly.
John Markoff is science and technology reporter for The New York Times. His new book is Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots. John, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you for making this time for us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.